This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to be the Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We are going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
So today, we're going to take a look at the historic global insurance losses in the first quarter.
Plus, Dish Network's plan to revive growth with low-priced 5G services.
But first, we want to talk about spending and how people are actually doing it. So it's spring, you got April, it's May, and actually we're seeing people go back in stores, not just buying online. For more, it's Bloomberg Intelligence Senior FinTech and Payments Analyst Julie Chariel. Julie, okay, as the economy sort of reopens, we get vaccinated, what kind of trends have you been noticing?
Yeah, so we just got some numbers in for April from SpendTrend, which tracks all card spending. And what we've seen is a really big spike in in-store retail growth. It was up 33% in April. Now, that compares to less than 9% for e-commerce spending. And so, you know, even though we could talk about having some tough comparisons, you know, last year easy comparisons, right? Last year was really bad in April. It was the bottom of consumer spending for because of COVID. So much easier to have a big growth number this April. And then you had some stimulus kicking in. Still, where we're seeing in-store so much stronger than e-commerce, it feels like, you know, people are just have been itching to get out and about. They've been going to retail locations. They've been buying apparel and accessories, luxury items, and they've been going to restaurants after, you know, quite a long time. And so we're seeing what was kind of feels like a bit of a honeymoon period, you know, maybe for retailers as consumers are finally feeling comfortable getting out there.
Can I just say, okay, anecdotally, so on Friday I had like an hour to kill and I was like, I'm just going to go shopping.
Good.
So I go to Zara, which is like the only store left on Lexington Avenue.
Yes.
And the line was around the block for Zara. Like, this is not, you know, like I need my face makeup.
We're desperate.
I know, it's crazy.
But the other side of that equation is every other store on Lexington Avenue between 58 and 59th is closed, with the exception of some chocolate shop. But so, Julie, I wonder, like, for me, one of the changes that's happened in terms of my consumer buying is I used to be a big cash guy. I'd have a lot of cash. I'd like to pay cash. I'd like to, you know,
like a big wad of cash in your
pocket. Big wad of cash,
like, hey,
you
guys.
Know, just like from the old trading desk days. But I'm just using the credit card and the debit card so much more. Are we hearing that from merchants in general?
Absolutely. And that's a big part of what this data is capturing, right? Because it's all card spending. And if it's not card spending, it's e-wallet spending, right? It's your PayPal, your Venmo, your Apple Card. And so a big part of this spending also is as people are going back, they're really not bringing cash into the stores or to the restaurants. They're paying more and more with their cards and their e-wallets. And that's going to make this kind of growth even faster than your overall retail growth.
Is that adoption rate also moving into people that haven't done it before? Like, my parents certainly aren't paying for stuff with Apple Pay. My husband's on the fence, but I'm like, I'm all for it. But so are we seeing like different generations, different kinds of people adopting it?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, PayPal talks about this whole trend that they've seen through the pandemic called silver tech, right? And it's been more about baby boomers and older in that generation really beginning to adopt more online payments and e-commerce, really because they kind of had no choice, especially early on in the pandemic. And in many cases, it's not going to stick with everyone, but in many cases, it is going to stick because people start to find it's pretty quick, it's pretty convenient. I start getting some attractive offers out there, right? The digital payments companies and the e-commerce companies are getting better and better at incentivizing you to keep coming back. They make it easy with different kinds of rewards if you're so inclined to follow up. And so it's getting to be much more part of what people do. Across the board, we're finding that the behavior is going to stick. Even if we have this little, as I call it, honeymoon period in stores right now, you know, the e-commerce stuff is going to stick. The digital payments are for the most part going to stick. It's not hard to use a credit card, but it's also not hard to use your e-wallet. And as you're becoming incentivized to use your e-wallet, you're likely to do it more and more.
All right. Hopefully you guys, this will impress you too. After 45 years of riding the New York City subway, I actually went with the Apple Pay at the subway, and it is very easy and very convenient. I was very proud of myself, just like the kids
Good
do. But I did have to call my 25-year-old daughter to ask her how to actually do all this. But she gave me the so now I'm in.
But now you wouldn't go back.
No, you can't go back. Once you go, all tech, you can't go back. But one of the questions I have, Julie, from the data, is there any regional bias? Because it seems like certain parts of the country opened up and are even more open than other parts of the country. And I mean, people are just bashing at bars and going nuts around different parts of the country. Are we seeing a regional difference in the data?
Yeah, we don't get that much regional breakdown from the spend trend data, but we are seeing sort of where you can see a little bit on the coasts where it's a little bit stronger, both in terms of going back to stores and using more digital payments. Right, so we're seeing a little more accelerated there. Maybe the vaccines came on sooner, maybe because they had the hardest time early on in the pandemic, and they've gotten over it, whereas other parts of the country are still struggling a little bit with cases. So we're seeing a little bit more, but it's not a real marked difference at this point. The contactless thing on metros is mm-hmm. such a big deal. Visa and MasterCard are so excited about it because they're doing that processing, whether it's for Apple Pay or whatever their card is being used. And they're seeing once it comes to metros, it really takes off in that region.
Julie, thanks a lot. Julie Chariel, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior FinTech and Payments Analyst.
Coming up on the program, value shares have outpaced momentum following first quarter earnings reports. We'll have the breakdown next.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, in this equity market, there is definitely a push and pull between, it seems, value and growth. And right now, value seems to be winning. Let's get some more color on this. We welcome Bloomberg Intelligence U.S. quantitative equity strategist Chris Kane. So, Chris, again, it's really, I would say, since last September, that rotation trade into value, maybe even to small cap stocks, has really worked well for investors as we start thinking about that, the reopening of this economy. What are you guys finding in your research?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the value rotation in the U.S. is certainly real. We have our long-short factor, so, going long cheap stocks, short expensive stocks, up about 25% over the last 6 months, up almost 40% over the last year. So, it's certainly been a strong trend. We think the trend could continue. The value factor did take a little bit of a breather over the last 2 months or so, but really seemed to reinsert itself recently. So, we think there's a lot of upside to go.
This is the obvious question. How do you define value?
Sure. So many ways to do it. At BI, we just keep it relatively simple, and we use price to sales and price to EBITDA as our two value metrics and kind of blend those together to form our value factor. But really anything that compares, the price to a fundamental to measure, cheap or expensiveness could be considered value. But, we try to keep it simple at BI and just do sales and earnings to price.
All right, Chris, if anybody has been in this market since, say, the end of the financial crisis, the strategy has been just go buy the big growth names, the big tech names, and put them back in your IRA and you're good to go. And you really don't have to think about them. And how about for the more cyclical play here, the value play, the small cap play? Is there a sense of how long this trade can continue to work?
Sure. Certainly longer. Let's say that. When you look at things like what we call valuation spreads. So we look at the average valuation for cheap stocks versus the average valuation for expensive stocks. That has obviously gone down to extreme levels over the last couple of years as value has not worked at all. And even the fact that value has come back over the last year, those spreads are still relatively cheap historically, which really argues for this value rotation to last even longer.
In terms of earnings potential, in the market for a lot of the names, and I'm talking like in general, they would have amazing numbers and the stock would do nothing. Was value different?
Yes. So we took a look at this recently You know, we separated the Russell 1000 into deciles based on value and momentum just to compare them, right? And we looked at our decile one momentum, so stocks with the strongest momentum, and decile one value or cheap stocks. And both cohorts really blew out earnings. I mean, it was a beat across the board. I mean, even value, you know, momentum even outperformed value as far as EPS beats. Yeah, value beat EPS by roughly 38% on average. Momentum was even better at 44%. The real difference was the price reaction after those earnings. So we looked at the excess one-day price reaction, so excess of the S&P 500, after these beats, and the momentum stocks actually went down by an average of 86 basis points, so underperformed the index by 86 basis points. And value was rewarded. It was had excess returns of 36 basis points. So it just really shows you that the market is valuing, for no pun intended, the value beats and really rewarding them over the momentum group.
One of the issues that the market's certainly grappling with, Chris, is inflation. Is it transitory or is it something more? Is this something I need to worry about? But in any case, inflation is generally good for some of these cyclical sectors, right? Is that kind of what your data is showing you?
Absolutely. Yeah. So we looked at, you know, the historical correlation between inflation expectations and our long short value factor. So by inflation expectations, we use the 10-year break-even rate. And, you know, it's been very positively correlated over the last year. Showing a current 52-week rolling correlation of about positive 0.6. And even if you go back further and look at the last decade, it's been consistently positively correlated. So we think a continued rise in inflation expectations should be a value tailwind going forward.
But if inflation winds up being transitory or temporary, does that necessarily mean a sell-off in value?
Well, it wouldn't be good for value, we don't think.
So you know, have to have inflation expectations or inflation stay high? And if so, like, what is that?
No, I don't think you have to.
Okay.
You know, I think inflation could taper off and we could still see the value work. Just because I say that just because the valuation of value, if you will, is still so extremely cheap. So I think it can still work, but it would lose, you know, one tailwind if inflation was indeed transitory, like some say.
All right. So I know you guys in BI have this scorecard and you kind of screen on a number of factors. What are some of the companies that screen well?
On a multi-factor basis?
Yeah.
Yeah. So some real estate companies like CBRE that has scored well recently. Lowe's and other retailers have scored pretty well recently.
Is there a sector that we can sort of glean here that, like, this kind of sector is the right kind of value that can move with the right kind of tailwinds?
Sure. You know, most of our, you know, we run a couple models. You know, mm-hmm. One is what we call sector neutralized and one is not sector neutralized. So with the not sector neutralized version, you know, some of those, you know, it's kind of dominated by financials, utilities, and industrials and materials. So those seem to be, you know, most of the value stocks. And those sectors, you know, seem to be working at the expense of some of the more high-flying stuff like tech.
Is there any other sector that just kind of jumped out at you guys is like, this is not the time?
I mean, I would say in general, from a factor perspective, you know, what I call conservative factors at this point should maybe be avoided. So what I mean by that is things like the quality factor and the low volatility factor. You know, I call those conservative factors because the long leg of those factors tend to have a lower volatility than the short leg. You know, to put it bluntly, those have not worked over the last year. You know, it's kind of been, you know, risk on at all costs. And until that sentiment changes, you know, we don't think those factors are really set up to do well. So I would stick with value, size, to a lesser extent, momentum. But I would avoid some of those more conservative factors like high quality and low vol.
All right, Chris, we appreciate that. Christopher Kane, Bloomberg Intelligence U.S. Quantitative Equity Strategist.
Well, coming up on the program, insurers reporting natural catastrophe losses in the first quarter that could reach $20 billion. We're going to have more on that next.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies in 130 industries worldwide.
Well, global insurance losses related to large natural catastrophes and COVID-19 could actually reach more than $100 billion for the full year. We want to break that down in depth here. We want to bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior fixed income analyst Arun Kumar. Arun, $100 billion sounds like a lot. Is that a lot in relation to other years that we've seen that have had a lot of disasters?
It's a little bit of both, yes and no. $100 billion is a large number, as you indicated. Just to give you a frame of reference, last year we had about $70 to $80 billion of bad weather-related losses, hurricanes, storms, and so on. And companies also booked losses for COVID-related expenses. And the total amount last year also was close to about $90 billion between COVID and the bad weather losses. This year, bad weather has already caused about, let's say, $20 billion of losses in the first quarter alone. And that's an unusually large number for the first quarter of any given year because January through March tends to be a fairly quiet period in terms of weather-related losses. Yeah, people don't typically associate hurricanes and storms and wildfires in the first 3 months of the year. Typically, that would happen between, let's say, May and October of the year. But this year, we've had several large events, like the freeze in Texas, if you remember, a couple of months back, where there was loss of power, and along with that, a lot of insurance-related losses.
All right, so COVID, let's focus on COVID a little bit. Just give us a sense. I mean, this is something that nobody probably had into their insurance policy. I'm not sure if it's an act of God or what it is. Just give us a sense of how the industry dealt with COVID in terms of covering losses across the economy.
Okay. So if you look at COVID being a global event, it has impacted companies, people's businesses all over the globe. But the way COVID has been dealt with in Europe is very different than how COVID has been dealt with in the U.S. Now, most of the claims under COVID for an insurance company would largely fall under two categories. One is business interruption. So let's say a company, a shop, a garage, whatever kind of business is forced to close. And if they have something called business interruption insurance, they file a claim for that. Now, in some of these policies, what people didn't realize is there's, in the fine print, there's an exclusion for either a pandemic or a virus-related claim that they didn't know, that the purchaser of the insurance did not know when they bought that policy.
So that means that in these, there was already an exclusion for the pandemic, for a pandemic.
In some policies. The policies are not similar across companies. So company A could have an exclusion, company B may not, company A may exclude the claims above a certain amount and so on. So it's fairly nuanced to each company's policies. But in the U.S., the courts have been generally supporting the insurance industry, saying, well, these exclusions apply and you don't have to pay much. So the amount of losses sustained by insurance companies in the U.S. have been relatively modest. Not zero, but relatively modest. In Europe, it's very different. There was a court ruling in the UK High Court in January that says insurance companies are liable to pay claims related to the pandemic. Insurance companies tried to wriggle out of it by trying to appeal it. They got subsequently overruled as well on their appeal. So companies are much more in the hook in Europe for COVID-related claims than their brethren in the U.S.
Give us a sense of how the balance sheets of the insurance industry look right now as we kind of tally up what's been a couple tough years in terms of losses, you know, kind of the stuff that they're used to dealing with, as well as COVID.
Balance sheets of insurance companies are extremely strong. Typically what happens is when a company, an insurance company, has a big loss in given 1 year, and let's say they lose all their profits for that given year, because whatever the item may be, COVID, bad weather, something, wildfires in California, you can pick your topic. what they tend to do is the next opportunity insurance companies get to raise their premiums, they do a very good job of raising premiums. Now, typically, let's say a big hurricane hits Florida and they pay out $20 billion of losses. The next time they get to renew property insurance, you can be rest assured rates are going to go up 5, 10, 15%.
Mm-hmm.
And they raise their rates in other parts of the country as well to subsidize the losses in Florida.
All right, Arun, really appreciate it. I feel like what the contracts look like next time are going to be super interesting, too. Arun Kumar, a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Fixed Income Analyst.
Coming up on the program, Dish Network is looking to find a seat at a crowded 5G wireless network table, plus the investment outlook for Berkshire Hathaway.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Well, Warren Buffett admits that he has missed some opportunities and some big opportunities. He's still sitting on a lot of cash, and we now know that Greg Abel would carry on Berkshire's culture as Buffett's successor. So what does that all mean if you're a Berkshire investor? Joining us now to break it all down is Matthew Paloza. He is a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior P&C Insurance Analyst. Hey, Matt, if I'm a Berkshire investor, why do I still like the stock?
Yeah, Alex, I think, you know, it's the same reason you liked the stock all along. This is a diverse group of businesses that are best in class, and I think what you really saw in the earnings in the first quarter is they rebounded sharply. It was against, you know, an easier comparison, but it really showed the earnings power of this company, and I think it's something that some people may overlook when they're looking for big splashy acquisitions, but what you're really getting here is kind of the cream of the crop across many different sectors.
All right. What you're also getting is arguably a conglomerate, I guess some people feel like. And if Mr. Buffett is not deploying capital more aggressively, then this is kind of a GDP story. Is that a call out there on this stock?
I think so. I mean, that's been probably the number one criticism of Berkshire is, you know, you're pretty much just buying the economy and, you know, you grow with the economy. But I would say I don't think that's true. I think the companies that you're buying is you're getting hand-selected, best-in-class companies that Warren Buffett has picked himself. So I would challenge that. I mean, the earnings rebounded by 20% in the first quarter, and I think it just turns around from here for the rest of the year.
What did he buy that he was happy about? What did he have regrets over the last year during the pandemic when, I mean, the equity fire sale was insane back last March?
Right, yeah. So we had wrote in the first quarter of last year that we thought they were really going to step up in a big way. And what you saw in the 2020 annual meeting was a very conservative, I would say scared tone from Warren Buffett. And they really didn't step up at all. And he said this year that he regretted doing that. Obviously, mm-hmm. if you had a crystal ball, you could see what was going to happen. But I think, you know, part of the ethos of the company is conservatism. And I think it was kind of on display a little too much in the first half of last year. But what they did turn around and do was buy back a ton of Berkshire stock. And I think investors really did like that because you could see the stock rally from the second half of the year when their repurchase really picked up through the first quarter of this year.
Yeah, I want to talk about that repurchase because I'm looking at the FA function on the Bloomberg terminal and I can see there's $464 billion of stock of cash on the balance sheet. What's really the plan here? Have they articulated a plan for what to do with that? I mean, it does not appear to be any sizable acquisition out there. They've been pretty quiet. They are buying back stock, but is there a strategy for what to do with that cash?
You know, I think it's going to be hold the course. I think, you know, last year's annual meeting, the tone was very somber. This year was better, but but it still left me with the feeling that they may not be in the market for a really big deal, because Buffett talked about competition from private equity, competition from SPACs.
Oh, yeah.
He talked up, you know, the complexities in looking for targets. So I think for now they may still sit on their hands. Again, it's Warren Buffett. They could pull the trigger on something tomorrow and I wouldn't be shocked, but my gut feeling is they still sit on it and they continue this share repurchase activity. I think they will do some of these, you know, for them, smaller deals in the $5 to $10 billion range, but I don't know if the elephant that Warren Buffett's looking for is out there.
How about a dividend? I mean, they don't even pay a dividend. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How about a 3% dividend yield? Would that kill them?
I think it would be great. You know, Buffett loves collecting dividends. He doesn't like paying dividends. I think the share repurchase wasn't about face. I don't think they do that with Warren Buffett as the CEO.
Well, what about with Greg Abel?
So I think Greg Abel carries on the tradition. I think it's much more likely to see a dividend under Greg. And, you know, Alex, they kind of let it slip in the meeting. They, in response to a question, said, yeah, Greg will continue on the culture. And then the next day, Buffett came out in an interview and confirmed it. So they kind of let that succession plan slip in the meeting. But I do think it's more likely under Abel, but I couldn't say 100%.
Really, really interesting stuff. Thanks a lot, Matt. We really appreciate it. Matthew Poloza, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior PNC Insurance Analyst.
All right, let's talk Dish Network here. Is this a satellite TV company on the decline, or is it an aspiring wireless 5G play? Let's bring in Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Telecom Analyst John Butler. John, it seems like we've been talking about Dish and Spectrum forever. They amassed all this spectrum, and then a lot of people thought they would either sell it to make some money or merge with somebody else and make shareholders money, but here they are. I guess they're going to build out a network? What's going on?
Yeah, that's right, Paul. So they have spent $20 billion on spectrum since 2008, and they really haven't put it to use in terms of building a wireless network until now. And so CEO Charlie Ergen is looking at the pay TV in secular decline and saying, I need to get into something where I can grow. And his answer is to build a next generation software based 5G network using the spectrum that he has accrued over the years.
How much is that going to cost?
So the estimated cost by the company is $10 billion. And my sense is that could be low. It's tough to say at this point. I think they could certainly get a large regional network built for $10 billion. It'll get them a start.
John, you know, Charlie Ergen's a notorious poker player, but you know, one could argue that he's misplayed his hand here. Does the market really want him to build another wireless network and compete against the big wireless players?
You know, I'll speak for myself, but I think the market feels the same way in that it's a stretch for Dish. You know, they're taking on large, well-funded incumbent carriers that are already in the 5G market. They will not cede share easily. And, you know, my sense is that they can really fight a price war much longer than Dish ever could. So I think they'll outlast Dish in any sort of move on Dish's part to buy share, if you will.
So if they build it out, let's just pretend. They build it out, say it costs $10 billion, they do an okay job. What do they do with it? Like, how can they compete with the Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile? Like, what do they do?
So their whole strategy, Alex, is to target the enterprise segment. So when you think about today's current wireless environment, it's mostly wireless services sold to consumers. And on the enterprise side, on the business side, they mostly buy raw bandwidth. They're really after getting the pipe and nothing more. 5G promises a lot more advanced services. So private network services where Honeywell or Boeing, for example, could have their own private network. Or managing large fields of devices like a dark factory, for example. So Dish is looking at that and saying that's a great niche for us. And if we forget all about consumer and the hyper-connectivity, competitive nature of that market and the cost of that, and just go after the enterprise market, we can really build a nice niche for ourselves. My argument against that would be all the large incumbent carriers are looking at it in the same way. It could be a very rich market as 5G evolves. And so my sense is that Dish is going to get outcompeted in that market over time.
All right, John, I'm still looking for the easy exit here to the Dish story. Is there any chance left that somebody would come along and buy their spectrum, if not the entire company?
I think there could be, Paul. There's definitely value in the assets there. You know, there's value in the spectrum assets, as you say. I mean, spectrum is something they stopped making years ago. So the reality is there's real value to that as the networks evolve over time. And then the pay TV business is very cash flow rich. And so, you know, even though it's a declining asset, and I think pay TV is going to continue to erode in coming years, the reality is it's a great cash cow. So there's options on that side of the equation as well for Dish.
But would they ever sell? I mean, it just feels like at this point, the ego is so entrenched.
You know, Alex, it has not been certainly part of the narrative that the company is spinning in any way. They have talked about a potential partnership or a wish for a partnership, I should say, with DirecTV. I'm not sure regulators would allow it. But beyond that, they haven't. They're not really acting like a company that's putting itself up for sale.
John, it's always good to catch up with you. John Butler, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Telecom Analyst. Thank you very much.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.